So you understand you've all signed up to hear about how chocolate fits into the gospel, basically. And you need to listen closely, because when you go back to church on Sunday, you need to be able to explain this seminar, because chocolate and Jesus don't normally go together. I need to ask a question first, just to get a... I'll come back to it later. It's sort of random off the top of my head question. Oh no, it's not off the top of my head. I want you to think whether you think that from 1960 to the end of apartheid in about 1990, when history looks back on the end of apartheid, whether the church will have been a significant part in ending apartheid. So put your hand up if you think historians will say, ignore Desmond Tutu. He was a loose Christian in the mix of it. But whether you think the Australian church, because I was in Australia a lot of that time, I don't remember hearing a sermon against apartheid. I'll come back to apartheid. Can the volume go up? We'll try. The technical team will deal with that. What I want to do is spend about 10 minutes going through a really complicated PowerPoint. Please try and stay with me, because it makes a very important point about chocolate. I want to compare an almost 200-year period from 1730 to 1915, that entire period, I want to compare it with the last 60 years. I want to compare it because that 200-year period was, if you like, the period of great growth in our recent history. That was the period when we went into almost every country on earth. That was the period when the church in England grew explosively. That was the period when the basis of the Americans being very dominantly Christian occurred, and a lot of growth in Australian Christianity occurred at the same time. So I want to compare the two black lines. Just to give you a feeling for the first black line, the first 200 years, this is the period when some of the great revivalists were there. That's Wesley, Whitfield, a guy called Finney, Moody and Spurgeon. I'm not talking about people like Calvin and Luther, who were theologians. I'm talking about people who were the leaders of their church. They were the ones who were doing all the preaching and church growing. Okay, so it's that sort of time. And in that period of time, we had what historians now look back and say they had three awakenings. The first, the second, and the third. The first is sometimes called the Great Awakening. And if you read American history, it has quite a part to play with early American history. There were gaps, there were hides with the Great Awakenings, and they came down again and went up again. But basically that 200-year period was a great time of the church flourishing. And what I want to compare is what I call below the line with above the line. Now, I could have put them the other way around, but on this occasion, below the line is what we pay for, but it's not part of our local face. Now, I'm going to ask you if you understand that by asking if you can give me an example of that. What we pay for, but people don't, non-church people wouldn't associate with us. So something that you and your local church is paying for, but for all intents and purposes, it's not part of your local witness. Richard, what's your example?
Christian Rex.
Ah, you think of, what do you do once a month?
Once a month, I'm a member of CMS, General Committee.
Okay, CMS is an answer. I was a Church Missionary Society missionary. I was sent from my local churches to Africa from St. Paul's Castle Hill, but the people in Castle Hill who didn't attend the church, they didn't know that. So St. Paul's was spending a lot of money on me and my family, but it wasn't part of the witness. Does that make sense? We pay for it, but it's not part of our local witness. And so in this period of time, you had a huge expansion where the church was paying for a whole stack of stuff. At the beginning of this period, the view of the English church was, if God wants to evangelize India, he'll do it. And this period involved a change where people like George Carey explained to the church, no, it's part of our task to go and do it. So you had the Baptist Missionary Society, the Church Missionary Society, Anglicare started during that period as the Home Missionary Society, the China Inland Mission. All of these things began in this period as people saw, yes, God wants us to go out. To give you an idea of how explosive this was, The China Inland Mission from 1860 when Hudson Taylor founded it to 1915 at the end of this period, 55 years, they started 200 hospitals in China. That's four a year. I have trouble thinking of four hospitals that have been started overseas in the church in Jesus' name in my lifetime. They were starting four every year. In 1 year alone, they had 100 new missionaries go to China. Just China. Not counting that, that's just one missionary society. Not counting the missionaries that went to Africa, that went to South America. This was an explosive period. John Wesley, at the beginning of this period, when he died, it was thought in the newspapers that he had 260,000 people meeting in Methodist meeting halls that he'd sort of gathered and nurtured in his lifetime. 260,000. One man, I understand that in Anglican churches in Sydney on a Sunday there are 30,000 people. So John Wesley by himself had eight times that number only in, that's in England. At the end of this period in 1904 was the largest international conference of evangelicals ever held, of evangelists. That was in 1904. That's 105 years ago. In 105 years we haven't beaten it. They got 5,000 people into London from 49 different countries. Australia sent 53 representatives to this conference. In the same year for the St. Louis Olympic Games, we sent two. Now how many do we send to the Olympic Games and how many do we send to international conferences of evangelism? So this period was hugely growing. So now my question comes, if that was happening then, in the last 60 years, can you think of any organisations that have begun that we pay for that aren't part of our local witness? New ones. World Vision started. Compassion. Habitat for Humanity, yep. No, Wycliffe was before this. I thought Wycliffe too, but Wycliffe started before this. I've just got a few. Let me tell you, on the left-hand box, I could have filled it 50 times. There was something starting almost every year. The right-hand box was a bit of a think. I just got Barnabas Fund, Operation Mobilisation. There's a few over there, okay? So they're things, but they're not part of your local witness. So it brings the question then, the top box is what is associated with us. We might not pay for it, we might pay for it, but when people think of your church, that's what they think of. Does that make sense in the difference? This is going to be harder for you to think of something. Can you think of something in that period that people in England, for example, would have associated with the English church, with Wesley, things that people would have associated with him? Because he was at the time paying for missionaries to go to America. People wouldn't have known that, but they knew what he was doing in England. Can anyone think of the biggie that we're sort of famous for in this period?
Abolition of slavery.
That's a classic. That only happened in the early 19th century because the English church understood that the abolition of slavery was a good idea. And the way they pressured the government to get Wilberforce's laws changed or brought into practice was they stopped eating sugar. And sugar was a big business, but all sugar was based on slavery. So Christians stopped eating sugar. It took about 30 or 40 years for Christians to understand that it was a good thing to stop eating sugar. And when they got it, the government changed the law. When we look back in history, historians say it was the evangelical awakening that stopped the transatlantic slave trade. They were known for it. You know, you would go up to your friend and say, "I stopped eating sugar." And people knew what you meant. There were signs on shop doors, "We don't serve slave sugar." Any other things in that period of time that as a church during the awakenings we were famous for? Or history would say, yes, we were part of?
Child labour laws.
Child labour laws, yes, very church related. Orphanages, yes, and some of these guys big on orphanages.
Education.
Education, both education for the poor was a big one, but also compulsory elementary education was a church-induced change.
Sunday schools?
Yes, Sunday schools. I don't know whether we've been famous for Sunday schools, but yeah, Sunday school, well, it's in the history books, but yeah, Sunday schools. You're going to get in trouble, guys, if you don't think of another one here. I'll say that again. You're going to get in trouble, guys, if you don't think of another one here. Women. Feminism comes out of this period. Christians are well known for that. And labour laws for women in industry, a big part of what Christians are involved in. I don't want that box up yet. What I want to do at that point is point out that the five guys there, the church leaders, were above and below the line. They were involved in the things that we pay for, so they were sending money overseas and a lot of evangelism that the local church wouldn't see, but they were also very much involved above the line in things that we were known for. Let me give a couple of examples on these guys. John Wesley had the highest earned income in England at his prime. So ignoring royalty and all those people, John Wesley was the richest person in England. Who would have thought? Why? He was famous because they published his sermons, and they also published a medical book that he wrote. He wrote the first medical compendium. When he used to walk from town to town when he wasn't preaching, in between, he used to have a guy walking behind him reading the most recent medical textbooks so that he could summarise them so that the poor would have access to healthcare knowledge and what to do. And he, during his lifetime, he put that through 24 editions. He's the most published medical author of the 18th century. And he made a lot of money out of that. He was also an Anglican minister, if there's an Anglican minister here, and he gave away 99% of his income. And he was known for having given away 99% of his income. His wife didn't like him for it. But he gave away 99%. He started orphanages. He started schools. Everyone knew when he stood up to preach, if you had a problem, you could go to Wesley. At the other end we can pick, I really like Moody. Does everyone know Moody and Sankey? I had some young guys in a Bible study, never heard of Sankey. Do you know Moody and Sankey? Yeah. They did a hymn book. They had six versions of the hymn book out. In 1900, the value of the royalties on hymn book number six was $38 million in current money. That's on hymn book number six. They had all six out at the same time. What did Moody and Sankey do with their money? They gave it away. They kept getting questions. What are you doing with all the money? They gave it away. They used to have a contest. They had a hymn book fund. And they used to have a contest every year whether it was Moody's project or Sankey's project. So they did YMCAs, large schools for the poor, boys' schools, girls' schools. They gave it away. Moody stood up. You knew he loved you. Okay? And I want to tie this into the Bible. Because this stuff above the line, what we do, is core in the New Testament. And I get it out of Romans 6:18. You are slaves of righteousness. Does anyone know that? I pick that because it's not long. I pick it because righteousness is one of those, it's a real church word, isn't it? It's not a rugby league word. It's not a New South Wales government word. Righteousness is a church word. If that's a core, even your neighbours will know that. You know, that's, you think that's church righteousness, and we're slaves of it. The problem is we've been misunderstanding it. I think we've been taking half of it for a long time. It's a really interesting word. It comes from a Greek word that I'm no good at pronouncing, and my wife ridicules me. That's the Greek word, dikaiosune. Can anyone guess how many times that word occurs in the New Testament? Now, I've got it on a box because it's a Greek word, and the trick is that it has two English words. So inside the box are two words, not one. But every time, 92 times that it occurs, the translator has to have a guess which one it's more meaning. Justice is one of the words, thank you. The other one is righteousness. So out of the box, dikaiosune, righteousness is there. That's just for your visual memories, and justice is there, okay? In the King James Version of the Bible, the entire 92 times are translated righteousness, because King James was responsible for justice, not the church. And so if you read the King James Version, the New Testament does not have justice in it at all, although it occurs in 92 key occasions. One of those is in Romans 6:18, where it says, you are slaves of justice. Those things above the line are justice, aren't they? Now, there's justice with me if I pay my workers correctly, if I've got someone working my factory. There's justice how I treat my children. But there's also how the church is supposed to be justice and light to people around them. We are slaves. Now, when Paul's writing to Romans, he's writing to the church as a group, just as I'm talking to you now. Paul was saying to the whole church in Rome, you are slaves of justice. And in our periods of great growth, we have always been known for acts of justice. That has been core to us. So my question comes, in the last 60 years, when history writes back on that last 60 years, what acts of corporate justice will the church be known for? We had a suggestion that Aboriginal work, I suspect that our good Aboriginal work went on before the 60-year period or right at the beginning, 50s, early 60s, if it did, and there was some good work. Yes. It hasn't been forgiven though, that's the problem. The movement's there, yeah. Civil rights in America. This is a pet subject of mine. Martin Luther wrote a letter from when he was in jail at Birmingham to the church, to the white church leaders, saying, "My main problem with this thing is you guys are pulling me back." It was a black church thing, that's true, but the white church was largely involved. And on a recent sermon I heard from someone in the know, Billy Graham has three large regrets in his life. One of the three was when he made the anti-Semitic comment to Richard Nixon. The third one I can't remember, but the other one was that he didn't get involved in civil rights. Can you imagine if Billy Graham had been on the front lines at Birmingham with Martin Luther King? I think that civil rights is one we missed.
I'm asking you, have we had any involvement with state
court
Guantanamo?
Have
we had anything to do with that?
In your church, did anyone preach on Guantanamo? No, I don't think we're big on Guantanamo. And apartheid, I don't think we'll be remembered for apartheid. In all the church services I went into, I don't remember apartheid. There are lots of things there that we could have been involved in. I was in Africa for 20 years, HIV, we're not there. If you think you've got HIV, we haven't even got a really clever stance on it yet, let alone doing anything about it. And HIV is by far the biggest injustice issue of the last 50 years.
Rick Warren's just made about $60 or $80 million out of his book, Purpose Driven Life, and gave a third of it to AIDS work.
Rick Warren gave a third of his money out of his book to AIDS work. Does anyone know why he got interested in AIDS work?
Because of his wife.
Because Bono got hold of his wife, and his wife. My point here is that Rick Warren's theology didn't lead him above the line. The point I'm trying to make is our current theology is not that we are church of justice, and that the big issues of injustice we're missing. We miss HIV. HIV, let me give you an idea of how bad this is. HIV is doing to Africa what the First World War did to Germany. And it's been doing it since 1983. HIV is doing more to Africa than the Second World War did to Germany. The only comparison is the First World War. And it's going on and on, and women are getting it because they're not economically stable. They're getting it because their husbands have rights over their body. They're getting it because they don't have access to condoms. They're getting it because they don't have access to income. Can anyone put their hand up when if they've heard a sermon on HIV/AIDS in the last 10 years? In their church. This is the largest injustice issue. Nothing matches this. This is wiping out an entire generation in Africa. And it's true that if you've got HIV in Africa, you do not go to the church. I was at a meeting with 6 evangelical pastors of large middle-class evangelical churches in Nairobi, and a lady stood there and she said, if you're poor and hungry, you go to a mosque. You do not go to a church. And none of the pastors had anything to say. We've missed the fact that we are slaves of justice. And there are lots of issues. We missed apartheid, we missed civil rights.
What's global warming going to do to Africa? Where are we on global warming?
Global warming is a large issue. It's not really going to bother us anywhere near it's going to bother Tuvalu. There are lots of issues we could be preaching on. Darfur is still going on. Burma is still going on. HIV I've mentioned. There are endless injustices and they're all complicated. What I want to do is give you a 101 and give you an injustice that we could get involved in. And I think it's the easiest international injustice of the last 200 years. It's an easier injustice to get involved in and change than anything up on the board. If ever there was a chance and God says, it's almost like we've sort of, okay God, we're hopeless at injustice, so he said, here's an easy one. If you're going to do one, do this one. And I want to explain why this is the easy one. And we could be known in 100 years, and it only needs to be Sydney Christians to do it. You don't need a worldwide movement to kill this one. And it's all to do with cocoa. Now to understand this, you've got to understand the cocoa industry. There are two countries, Ivory Coast and Ghana. Between them, they make 70% of all cocoa in the world. 43% comes from just the Ivory Coast. So, and there are 4 main cocoa buying companies in the world. So they buy all the world's cocoa and they pool it. Largely they pool it. Now that's important. So you've got 70% comes from Ghana and Ivory Coast, but when a factory wants to make, you know, when Coles wants to make chocolate, they buy out of the pool. Now those 4 companies over the last 20 years have gradually, because there's only 4 of them, lowered the price of cocoa. That means that farmers in Ivory Coast who own their own cocoa farm and have owned it probably for generations and are producing a product that we love to eat have over the last years been moved into what is technically defined as poverty. They are living on less than $2 a day. At the same time that they produce the cocoa that we eat off our supermarket shelves. That means that they can no longer afford to send their children to school. They keep them home to work on the farms. So somewhere between 200 and 280,000 children in Ivory Coast work on the farms and don't go to school because we don't pay enough for cocoa. As if that's not enough, approximately 12,000 children have been taken from surrounding countries and enslaved on cocoa plantations to cut operating costs. So there are 12,000 child slaves in the cocoa industry. Tim Costello says that because of the pooling of cocoa, when you eat chocolate, there is blood in every bite. This is a luxury item for which there are 250 at least thousand children out of education and 12,000 children in slavery. They're locked in a room when they're not working. They have a been in the toilet in the corner for their toilet. They work 16-hour days. It's in the sun. It's equatorial. That's why they grow cocoa. It's hot. They have large machetes. They get injuries. They get no medical care, no education, just for cocoa. Now, the question is, of course, did I just make that up? Did I just make that up? Well, fortunately, this was noticed in 2001 by the American Parliament. And they were going to pass a law that said that all chocolate needed a child labour-free certification on it. And when what we now call Big Chocolate, so that's the cocoa buyers and the chocolate manufacturers, heard about this, they said, that's not a good idea. Now that we're aware that there's all this slavery in cocoa, now that you've made, we didn't know. We'll fix it. You don't need to make a law. So they signed an agreement, and you can Google this if you like. It's called the Harkin-Engel Protocol. This is a UN document under the ILO, the International Labour Organization, signed between the four cocoa buyers and all the major chocolate manufacturers in the US. And you Google this, you can pull up the original document in PDF form and see the signatures. This was signed in 2001, that by 2005, child labour would be eliminated from cocoa manufacturing. 2005 passed with no gains. So they made a sort of a lower agreement where they said, well, that was really difficult, so we'll give us a simpler one. We'll decrease child labour by 2008. 2008 passed. It's the same. The only improvements we've had, you might have heard that Cadbury's went fair trade in their dairy milk brand from Easter next year. Walk through Coles or Woolworths and look how much chocolate is Cadbury's dairy milk. It's not a lot. There's all the Coles branded, there's the Woolies branded, there's Lindt, there's all these other chocolates. The Coles dairy milk, the Cadbury's dairy milk is not a lot, but that in Australia, only Australia, going fair trade for that amount of chocolate has taken 40,000 families out of poverty. It's put their children in school, and it's given them health care. 40,000 families just for dairy milk Cadbury going fair trade. That was voluntary from Cadbury. Cadbury's UK is doing the same thing. But you've got all the other chocolates. And there are some bad companies out there that don't change under public pressure. The only way this is going to change is if one large chocolate eating market insists on a child labour-free certification on their chocolate. Say, for example, that New South Wales made a law that you needed to have a child labour-free certification on all chocolate by the year 2015. Because of the way the companies buy from the pool, the whole pool would have to be child labour-free. Does that make sense? There is no other pool. So Coles can't say, well, we'll buy from the good pool. There is no other pool. So you only need one market to go fair trade to say that all chocolate needs a child labour-free certification on it. Now, Australia is already signatories to anti-slavery laws. We're signatory to child labour laws. You would think it'd be a snap to get a law passed that said, well, the laws are already there. All you've got to do is put the label on your chocolate. Surely there's no slavery in your chocolate. So the opportunity is there for the church in Australia to get the New South Wales government to pass a law that there should be a child labour-free certification on all chocolate by a certain year. Now, what's the effect of this? Think of this. 34% of Ivory Coast is Christian. What will the effect on their witness to their neighbours be when their neighbours' kids say to them, why are you in school now? Where did that clinic come from? It's because our brothers in Sydney loved us. This is better than Wilberforce got, because the transatlantic slaves never really found out in their lifetime why they were free from slavery. We have a chance to start filling up our box. There's nothing easier than cocoa. Now I'm praying that the Holy Spirit has people here who are going to help in this. I spoke, so far I've spoken in Fig Tree, in Castle Hill, in Mossman, but here there are people from I don't know how many churches. You can go back and explain to one other person what I've said today, that we are slaves of righteousness, and get that person and your church active in this. We can witness to an entire nation in Africa just by eating chocolate and just by getting our parliament to make a law that should be a snap. Are there any questions about that? Couldn't we just have